Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And today I'm joined by a cartoonist, illustrator, editor, curator, college instructor, and author, whose books include Cartooning, Philosophy and Practice, Comics, Easy as ABC, and Aesthetics, a Memoir. His work has appeared on the cover of the Patton Oswalt album, My Weakness is Strong, and in the New York Times Magazine, the Paris Review, the Baffler, McSweeney's, and the New Yorker. Ivan Brunetti, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that we are currently in the midst of KBOO's all-important membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our programming and that you'll take a moment to become a member of KBOO. Because we're still being cautious and not yet opening up our studios, we don't have volunteers in the station to take your calls right now, but you can show your support by giving online, kboo.fm, or text KBOO to 44321. KBOO is one of the very last media outlets that still brings you local and independent news, music, and public affairs. We've been doing this here in Portland for over half a century. And this program has been coming to you for 18 years now, inviting important cultural figures into the studio and venturing out to events that might fly beneath the radar of the big media monoliths. So yes, you can support this very special programming today by going online to kboo.fm/give or simply text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. So your book, Cartooning, Philosophy and Practice, was the winner of the 2012 Eisner Award for Best Academic or Scholarly Work. And comics legend Chris Ware, the creator of Jimmy Corrigan and Rusty Brown, said, "Ivan Brunetti is the greatest teacher of cartooning in the whole world, really." High praise indeed, especially if you put Linda Barry into the competition.
Well, that was very nice of Chris. And Linda has been doing amazing stuff teaching, and she uses my book a bit. And she's taken it, and she's doing what I hoped all the teachers would do, which is actually just use it as a starting point and then kind of bring their own ideas to it and do things that I would have never expected with the project. So Linda's taken it to the stratosphere. And Chris is one of probably my closest friend, actually. So I'm sure he was just being nice, but I appreciate his kind words. When I first started teaching and I had no idea what I was doing.
And this was at Columbia College, Chicago?
Yeah, for an adult education class. And I did it a couple of times. But then the continuing education program got discontinued at the school, unfortunately. But a lot of that book came out of the very first class I taught where I was just improvising. But I remember posting a lot of reflections on teaching. I made like a little website for myself. And then people started stealing from it and not crediting. I guess they call it the IP now, right? The intellectual property. And I saw other people on the internet just outright take everything, my projects, the way I worded everything, you know, and I'm like, this is just cribbed from what I wrote. So needless to add, that kind of made me a little upset. So over time, I thought, you know, I should really just make a proper book and put my name on that before it becomes public domain. So I just wanted to make sure that somehow, like maybe my name should be on there. And that's what led to doing the cartooning book was just to protect this thing that I developed.
Yeah, you've got a series of lessons in the book, and the lessons cover the philosophy and the practice behind comics, the, you know, the history, the forms, the techniques. But the goal of the book seems to be you want to push the reader towards self-expression and clear storytelling. And yes. And one of the important skills that you seem to want to teach your students is how to develop their intuition. That actually sounds like pretty heavy lifting.
Yeah, it's not even, I mean, the funny thing is that it's not even about cartooning at all. It's about understanding how ideas evolve, and you can apply the lessons in there to whatever you want. I never really thought of it as a how-to book. And it's not that I want people to draw in my style. I don't think that's a good idea. I show that style in the book to prove that you could use a very simple style and actually tell a complex story that you wouldn't expect from a simple drawing style. So it's more to give people the permission to draw, even if they're not technically advanced with it or have stopped drawing, maybe never even have drawn. I'm really fascinated by people using the book that aren't seasoned pros at drawing and doing comics. It really is more a philosophical look at the process of creation, which I think is intuitive. At some point, you have to trust your intuition because there is no blueprint for creativity. I mean, people have been trying for probably thousands of years to create something like that, where it would just, you know, make somebody creative. It's more to kind of give permission to people so they can try to do it and see what comes out. And they might decide that they'd rather stick with prose or to make a film or to write poetry or just go back to painting or something. You know, maybe they're already doing visual art or photography. And I think the book would help anybody doing that stuff because it's just about how a visual narrative might evolve and how you find your own structure for what you're trying to communicate.
I'm reminded of a quote that I read, a quote from you. You said, "What attracted me to comics was that it was a very marginalized thing." And, you know, we look back on the 1960s as sort of a golden era for underground comics, uninhibited storytelling, really personal storytelling. Mm-hmm. And then there was the alternative comic scene of the 90s, kind of resurgence of that spontaneity, that personal vision. None of that happened without controversy, though. And I'm wondering, is there a place anymore for transgressive comics? You know, is self-censorship replacing self-expression?
That's a great question. I'm going to answer yes. In a word, I mean, I think that is true. I have to live with the fact that I put out certain kinds of comics a long time ago. Those haunt me. I mean, to this day, those are used against me. They've been used against me for different jobs I've tried to get over the years, especially in teaching. And I mean, I get it. I understand why people feel that way. They were transgressive. I don't think I was doing that on purpose. To me, that was like just, that's where I was in my life. I had all these dark thoughts, and I can differentiate between a dark thought and actually taking action. You know, I never really did anything. I'm the most harmless person there is, but I've had horrible thoughts, you know, but I can make that distinction. But I think for a lot of people, maybe it's just, it freaks them out. And so I don't know. I definitely look over my shoulder a lot more, and more and more, I'm just interested in doing work for myself.
Robert Crumb said that drawing the most outrageous images he could come up with was his way of purging his demons. And considering how his brothers turned out, that kind of purging may have been the wisest move for him.
Right. And, but even he has said, like, I don't know, was it good that I put it out in the world? The jury's going to be out forever on things like that. It's sort of how I feel about myself. Like, it helped me therapeutically to purge a lot of this stuff. Did it help someone else? I don't know. I hope so. I hope it didn't have a detrimental effect on anybody. And it's not as if I sat down and said, okay, I'm going to purge my demons now. I didn't know what I was doing. I just knew something had to come out of me. But that's the way I feel now. Like, whatever I'm putting out there, that's what needs to come out of me at that time. I don't know. Like, is it better or worse than before? Or is it interesting or not interesting? I mean, time will tell. And the jury is out there. It's not me. So we'll see. I think, like, good work will last. It will outlast any trends or societal things. I mean, it might take 100 years. Sometimes it takes 500 years for something to be appreciated. And things definitely wane, you know. I mean, look at classical art, you know, that after the fall of the Roman Empire, there's like 1,000 years of the Dark Ages, and it takes 1,000 years for people to rediscover what now we call classical, like Greek and Roman art, and then you have the Renaissance. But like, there's a 1,000-year gap to rediscovering something, right? So, I mean, now we're at, things move so fast that like something happens and there's a month-long trend. It seems like this huge thing, you know. But like, if you look at it in the big picture, I think quality will always win out. And I think sincerity and honesty and trying to look at life the way it is, as imperfect as artists are. I mean, I can't think of a more imperfect kind of person than an artist. Certainly, we shouldn't be models of most behavior. You know, and I just think if there's something there that is deep and true, it will connect with people eventually or reconnect. You know, and that's all you can do is do, I mean, just try your best to make something that will outlast you. And you can't do that if you're just trying to manufacture something or calculatedly come up with something like that. It has to, it's beyond like any individual. I think it's at some point, like where any kind of art, whatever it is, the creative person is just a conduit for so many things.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Counsor, and we're talking today with cartoonist, curator, editor, and teacher, Ivan Brunetti. He's the author of Cartooning, Philosophy and Practice, and Aesthetics, a Memoir. Before we get back to the conversation, I'd like to take a moment to remind our listeners that KBOO is in the midst of our membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our programming and that you'll take a moment to become a member of KBOO. Our studios are still closed to phone volunteers, but we have all sorts of options for donating. If you'd like to pledge on the web, you can visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now let's talk some more with our guest, Ivan Brunetti. Some people would count iconography as comics. You look at Ethiopian iconography and there's, you know, words and pictures together in sequence. And, you know, in the early Orthodox and Catholic churches, there were these stained glass windows that told a story everybody could understand, even if they were illiterate. And I know you've grown up, you've had your struggles with the Catholic Church. And as your own art gets a little bit more iconic, I'm sort of wondering how much that early exposure, how much effect that religious exposure had on you.
I mean, it's probably just seeped in without me knowing it. I mean, I really prefer the early Renaissance period of art to the later. That's more, you could say, more advanced in many ways in terms of technical, the proficiency that artists developed with perspective and space and depicting volume. But I really like the stiff figures, like before they totally figured all that stuff out. I think there were some paintings from churches and frescoes and things like that that really had a deep impact on me. One of them is the Lamentation by Giotto. That's so deeply embedded in my brain. I realized that like everything I do somehow stems from that. And that's something that I saw at a very young age somewhere before I could even process it. It's actually part of a chapel that is a comic. I mean, the whole building is a, not only like one, there's multiple stories and then there's stories within stories, and the ornament, which is actually painted, it's not really structural. It's like painted to look like there's these extra structures, and there's other images in there, and those are other stories going on. So it's like a Chris Ware comic, the chapel that this painting by Giotto is, it's a part of. It actually uses a lot of techniques that are used in comics, and the way the fresco panels sometimes connect to each other and there's visual rhymes. The Scrovegni chapel is where it is. But so that painting I saw at a very young age, and just everything about it in terms of like a gesture. And there's also this weird combination of the Earthbound. It's a scene of Christ has died and his mother is crying over his body. But then there's this cosmic element of where the angels are crying as well. And so there's like this combination of the, I'm not going to say mundane, but the physical, the corporeal, the Earthbound. And at the same moment, there's this other cosmic, or at least I think that's what's trying to be communicated through, you know, Christian beliefs. But I mean, everything I do still kind of looks like the way I would think of a portrait. It's always rooted in some kind of iconography. So it's deeply embedded in my system. And I grew up in Italy, you know, so I was surrounded by these things. And clearly it's seeped into my view of things. And that's separate from my dislike of all the injustices and abuses of the church. So,
yeah, you grew up in a Renaissance castle town in the hills above the Adriatic Sea. You lived in Italy until you were 8, and you've talked about the years between 4 and 6 as being your most fruitful as an artist. You said that the drawings are careful, sincere, and free of pretension.
Yeah, I do believe that the drawings I did at that age, I just wasn't self-conscious in any way. I just wanted to draw, and I didn't think about why or what I was trying to do. You know, you don't think when you're 6 years old, you don't think like, well, my work is about whatever, you know, like I think I just, that's the last time I remember unself-consciously doing something and just enjoying it. And then you become aware of what you're doing and people judging it. And it took some of the enjoyment away for me and became self-conscious. And now I'm at a point where I worry about everything and I talk myself out of things. But, you know, maybe I just miss the innocence of that, that I was doing something and I didn't know why and I didn't care. I just did it because I knew I wanted to, you know, something was compelling me that I couldn't explain.
I'm wondering, was there more of an appreciation in Italy for art and culture? I remember you saying that the word disegno, you said that literally meant drawing, but also design. And when you were growing up, you said, I learned not only how to read from comic books, but also how to see.
So literally, that's the translation of the word drawing is disegno. But obviously, the word design comes from that. There's something where drawing and design are deeply embedded, I think is what I'm trying to get at. So through drawing, you will learn design. I think, if you really want to get technical with it, like I think during the Renaissance, those artists made a distinction between disegno and colore or drawing versus color. And the people that understood color more, they would do oil painting, which is a different process than a fresco painting. A fresco is a design process because the paint dries a different color totally. And you can only work in small sections at a time and you can't blend the way you can with oil paint. So the artists that were better at kind of planning the drawing in steps and stages, it's more laborious and tedious. That's more connected to drawing. To me, like there's something about composition and drawing are so deeply interconnected, you know, and I think just by drawing a lot, you absorb design principles.
Well, you were talking about your early comics, and you did a whole lot of experimentation back in the 90s and the aughts. You published the comic Schizo. The first 3 issues were collected in the volume Misery Loves Comedy, and Schizo number 4 won the 2006 Ignatz Award for Outstanding Comic of the Year. You were doing all of these forms and sometimes just note perfect imitations of the style of James Thurber, Ernie Bushmiller, Charles Schulz, Dick Brown. Who am I missing here?
Oh, well, I mean, I appreciate it. I think I learned to draw from copying other cartoonists. And for a while, I was getting a lot of offers to do things that mimic something else. And It's a lot of hard work. And I was like, I don't really want to be the mimic guy. I'm not that good at it. I mean, I've been copying Schulz and Disney and a few others and Beetle Bailey, et cetera, since I was a little kid. So I mean, everybody learned from copying someone else. That's kind of the way art was taught for centuries. Like, apprentice, master, the person that's really good at it shows you, here's how I do it. And then you learn how to do that, you know, and then you'd become an artist and then you teach someone else. But that's how things were taught, say, during the Renaissance era. It's not the way we teach art today in an art school or something where you're like, okay, you're going to develop your own thing.
Yeah, I'm wondering if your big-headed characters, a lot of that comes from your appreciation of Charles Schulz when you were younger.
Oh, totally, yeah. I mean, it's to the point of I should be ashamed of myself for stealing that. Not only the big heads, but the proportion of the figure to the panel border, the proportion of the lettering to the character. Like, I mean, to me, everything is rooted in Charles Schulz. I mean, the first thing I was copying in Italy was all these Disney comics. And then when I came to America, that's really when I saw Peanuts. And I got obsessed with it right away. I mean, even like when I was younger, I was probably copying things that were copying Schulz and not even realizing it. But I'll freely admit that I owe my life to Charles Schulz because he showed a way of doing it that allowed me to tell stories. So I will proudly say I am in the tradition of Charles Schulz.
I guess some of the controversy you were talking about earlier was when you took the Peanuts characters and Nancy and Sluggo to some very dark places when you were in these pitch black moods.
I'm sorry I did that. That wasn't there. That was against their will. I kidnapped them. I kidnapped the characters and tortured them. And again, you know, that was more like I knew I could copy those things and then I could plug them into my twisted dark fantasy or whatever. And I think it was just not as thoughtful as I could have been. But, you know, I try to do that in a limited way. But yes, I guilty as charged.
One of the things that was really interesting in your book, Misery Loves Comedy, is that you recruited your therapist to write the introduction. She was a good sport. So were you, for that matter.
Yeah, she hadn't even seen the contents of most of that. I just asked her to do it. She knew that, I mean, I talked about like that I did these really dark comics and they're scatological. And so I warned her, but she's like, you know, that's fine. I don't have to, you know.
Well, she says of you, he did the forbidden and the world didn't end. So the
that's fear a big thing with, in my therapy that's still going on, just to give you an idea. That book came out in 2007. But there's this big thing about, I guess, the way my mind works. If I do certain things, I have a feeling like I'll be annihilated. It's comes from like a fear of a parental figure. When you're a kid, you're at the mercy of that. She talks a little bit about that in there. And so it has a lot to do with like procrastination and not feeling confident ever. But yeah, there's this idea that if I do something wrong, I'll be completely annihilated, which is a child idea. But even as an adult, I still am enthralled to this and I haven't been able to completely shake it. So.
But, you know, some artists or some creative people, if they're in a dark space, they can't work. And you've said, to make art, it is an act of will to fight demons that I'm battling at the time. So you broke through in some way.
For a little while. I think now I've been I've been defeated. I'm no Saint George. The dragons have won out. It's I've had times where I've been maybe more manic, who knows, and I had like this crazy energy and I had to put something out there. And as I've gotten older, I don't know, I just don't feel that way very often. I'm actually trying to work more toward enjoying it, like where maybe if I start drawing, like I'll start to feel like I get some pleasure from it. Again, like that childhood idea of where it was not a self-conscious act. And but yeah, I'm not one to romanticize depression. I hope I haven't done that by writing about it. Sometimes I worry that I did. I mean, I've been diagnosed with a certain level of bipolar, and mostly just kind of depression. But there have been times of you get like a crazy energy, not always a positive one. It can be very destructive. And in those moments, you start to feel invincible or these crazy delusional ideas. And I know I've written things in that state of mind. And I worry sometimes that maybe that stuff comes off as almost like romanticizing it, because I really don't like in films or books where it's romanticized, because it's actually really horrible and destructive, and it does not help me creatively. And I think that's true for most people. And most people going through severe depression aren't able to make anything. You're barely able to get out of bed, so you're not going to be painting your masterpiece. Like when I've gotten something done, I had to get past the depression. It wasn't like the depression was inspiring me. It doesn't give me the energy to draw. It's like when I stop feeling that way for a little bit, I'm able to get to the drawing table. And then occasionally you get into a flow state or the zone or whatever people want to call it. And it starts to feel like pleasurable a little bit, you know. It takes a long time to trick myself to even start, though, because I can never start something with that feeling. But if I stick with it long enough, I do start to feel better. It's just, you really want to find ways to get through this stuff, whatever it might be.
You've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And we've been talking today with cartoonist, curator, editor, and teacher, Ivan Brunetti.
Yeah, you forgot Bon Vivant. Or Mal Vivant.
Even better. He's the author of Cartooning, Philosophy and Practice, and Aesthetics, a Memoir. Ivan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your work, where would they look?
I have a website that I don't keep up with, ivanbrunetti.com, or my Amazon author page lists all the books that are in print. That pretty much covers it. So,
well, we hope that everybody has been enjoying our programming for KBOO's membership drive. Before we go, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that this community radio station needs your support, as our physical studios are remaining closed for the time being. To become a member of KBOO or to arrange for a donation of any size, please visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. Or if you prefer, you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at wordsandpicture.